It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the big winners at last night's Grammy Awards and a year in music. First, we learned last week from reporting in the New York Times that President Trump ordered White House counsel Donald McGahn to have the Justice Department dismiss special counsel Robert Mueller. This was back in June. Mueller is heading up the probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election and whether there was any coordination between Russians and the Trump campaign. McGahn refused to fire Mueller and said he'd quit instead of following that order the president ultimately backed down. The president was asked if, in fact, he had wanted to fire Mueller. He was in Davos, Switzerland last week for the World Economic Forum. Here's what he had to say.
Why did you fire Robert Mueller?
Fake news, folks. Fake news.
What's your message today?
Typical New York Times fake stories.
Mr. Trump.
Confirmation of the reports that Trump had wanted to fire Mueller have come from across the spectrum, including Fox News, where host Sean Hannity reversed his earlier claims that it was fake news and now says that the network has fact-checked it. Frank Turkheimer is an emeritus professor of law at the UW-Madison. He served as a federal prosecutor in Wisconsin and as a Watergate prosecutor. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be on the show with you.
How serious do you see it as being if the president did, in fact, try to fire special counsel Robert Mueller?
Enormously serious, and the terminology you use almost fits the statute. The obstruction statute is one of the few federal statutes that embraces with it attempt. So it's not just a crime to obstruct justice, but in the words of the statute, to corruptly endeavor to obstruct justice, meaning to try, which is exactly the word you used. And it's pretty clear that that the president tried to get Mueller fired and end the investigation, and that brings us pretty close to a violation of the statute, because there was no valid reason for it. I mean, the regulations say that special counsel can be fired for service if he or she does certain things, and none of those kicks in.
Is proving intent part of the condition of obstruction of justice, saying that the president in this case had given that order with the intent of thwarting this particular investigation?
Well, the state of mind that the statute uses is corruptly, but I think when you say intent, if you just put the adjective bad in front of it, you're saying the same thing, the wrong intent or a bad intent. And, that's always a question that has to be proven. You always prove it circumstantially, that is, by looking at the surrounding circumstances. And I think that the principal surrounding circumstance here is that the president wanted him fired without, for no valid reason. I mean, just to stop an investigation. And that's not one of the grounds you can fire him on. And that would be a fairly strong indication that the intent here was improper or corrupt, as the statute says. When you put the whole thing together and take all that's happened in connection with the special counsel and the investigation, you can draw other evidence of bad intent. Being alone with Comey and asking Comey to drop a case. I mean, why did the president ask everybody else to leave the room? And as I recall, Reince Priebus and maybe somebody else were very reluctant to leave because they thought it was a bad idea for the president to be alone with Comey, but the president shooed them on out. I mean, if you want evidence of bad intent, it comes right out of that scenario. So it's there. I mean, and the question is whether exactly how Mueller is going to handle it.
If this is, in fact, obstruction of justice, what can Mueller or anyone do with that information? Can the president be prosecuted for this? Is this something Congress would have to deal with?
Well, I would be surprised. I mean, fortunately, in the entire history of the Republic, a sitting president has never been indicted. In the case of Richard Nixon, the evidence was strong that he participated in a conspiracy to obstruct justice, and he was named as a co-conspirator in the main Watergate indictment, but he wasn't named as a defendant. But at that time, there was a viable impeachment process pending in the House of Representatives, and ultimately that worked. I mean, the House Judiciary Committee, when it had all the evidence, voted 38 to nothing to have the president impeached, and that certainly portended impeachment by the House and removal by the Senate. I doubt, I would be surprised, but I, you know, since we're writing on a clean slate, we can't be sure that Mueller would actually charge the president with the crime of obstruction. He'd probably lay out the case in a report, which he, by statute, is required to file. And then it would be up to the House of Representatives, and that's not to say they're going to do anything with it, but it would, the ball would be in their court.
Talking to Frank Turkheimer, former federal prosecutor in Wisconsin, former Watergate prosecutor, looking at the latest news about President Trump reportedly attempting to fire Robert Mueller. I want to give a listen now, getting to the congressional side of things. I want to listen to Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on ABC's This Week talking about what, if anything, should happen in light of this report.
I don't know. I believe it's something that Mueller should look at. We're not going to just say it's fake news and move on. Mueller's the best person to look at it, not me opine about something I don't know. I'm sure that there'll be an investigation around whether or not President Trump did try to fire Mr. Mueller. We know that he didn't fire Mr. Mueller. We know that if he tried to, it'd be the end of his presidency.
If he tried to, it would be at the end of his presidency, says Lindsey Graham. Do you agree, Frank Turkheimer?
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, maybe Senator Graham is a little bit, he has a better sense of what's going on in the House than I do, but I'm not that sure that the House would act, pick up the impeachment cudgel if Mueller comes to the conclusion that there was, you know, obstruction of justice here. I should add also that the president doesn't have the power to fire the special counsel. And that's probably one of the reasons he's so ticked off at Sessions. But the law is that only the attorney general can fire the special counsel. And in this case, that would be Rod Rosenstein, who was acting in place of the attorney general, who recused himself. So that, and I think that's one of the reasons McGahn was so forceful about it, because if the president wants directly to fire the special counsel, he's acting against the law. The law doesn't give him that power. He would first have to fire Rosenstein, and then direct whoever succeeds Rosenstein to fire the special counsel. And that's why I think McGahn foresaw a reenactment of the Saturday Night Massacre, where once again, the president didn't have the power to fire the special prosecutor.
I want to give a listen now to House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California talking to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. There's the question of whether Congress should do something to protect Mueller from a possible future firing. Here's a listen.
Would you be open, if there is a bill that protects, you know, something? There's a couple of bills in the Senate. One would be having a three-judge panel review a decision if the president did fire Mueller to see if it was done on fair grounds. Would you be open, if that bill is attached to the budget bill, would you support that? Would you let that go through versus...
Look, I think we should focus on the budget, because military needs their funding. Why are we playing other games with something else? Let's take the issue that's right before us. He's cooperating right now.
Would you support legislation to protect Mueller?
I don't think there's a need for legislation right now to protect Mueller.
Frank, do you think there's a need for Congress to pass a law that adds extra protection to Robert Mueller?
You know, I tell you, I watched that program, and that was kind of aggravating. I mean, basically what McCarthy is saying is there's no need until the president actually does it, in which case it's going to be too late. That's absurd. Yeah, I think it would be very helpful to have added protections for the special counsel, especially because the president has indicated a desire to get rid of them without any of the existing grounds applying. I think it's... The special counsel needs protection, and that would be a very useful statute, but not one that you pass, after it's too late.
This is all going on as some Republicans in Congress and the president are targeting FBI officials, saying they've shown signs of bias in the investigation of corruption, of not investigating Hillary Clinton enough and doing too much to investigate Donald Trump. What do you make of those efforts to discredit, in effect, some of the FBI leadership?
I don't get that. I mean, the FBI leadership is Republican. Comey was a Republican. Mueller is a Republican. Rosenstein's a Republican. I mean, that's a total and complete distraction from... the fact of the matter is, Mueller has a specific mission. He was appointed for certain reasons to look into possible violations in connection with the Russian participation in our election and obstruction of justice. That was within his mandate. That's not something he just plucked out of the air and said, I'm going to do this. And these other things have nothing to do with Mueller's mandate, and they shouldn't serve as to diminish his mandate in any way, because they can't.
Frank, as we wrap up, I won't ask you to predict the future, because we keep seeing, I think, things that surprise us here all along the way. But what are you watching for next?
What am I watching for next is to see how long Rod Rosenstein remains in that position. That's the next thing. I frankly don't know that the president is going to be restrained. If he really wants to do something, he's going to do it, and then all hell's going to break loose.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That's Frank Turkheimer, Emeritus Professor of Law at UW-Madison. He served as a federal prosecutor and was a Watergate prosecutor. He joined us for a look at the latest in the Russia probe and reports that the president had ordered the dismissal of Robert Mueller last summer. First, the 60th Annual Grammy Awards took place last night, lasting over 3.5 hours. Viewers saw performances from Lady Gaga, Cardi B, and Bruno Mars, a Kendrick Lamar mashup, U2, Elton John, and more. Justin Barney is with us now. He's the music director for Radio Milwaukee. Justin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me start by asking a real public radio-style question. As a music critic, a music director, do the Grammys matter?
Well, I've been trying to convince myself that they do matter. This year proved that they really don't.
Well, and I want to get into why, and I suspect I know why. I want to give a listen to a performance by the big winner of the night, Bruno Mars. He took home all the awards, basically.
Yeah,
not
just
all.
About.
Here he is with the song Finesse with Cardi B. So lots of politics at this show last night, Justin. The Me Too movement, DACA, U2 calling out President Trump, this and that, and all the awards, and a lot of serious nominees for the big awards, and really a good party album, a dance album, wins all these awards.
Yes, it kind of really felt like it undercut the entire message of the Grammys. The Grammys last night tried really hard to be important. It tried really hard to send a lot of political messages. Hillary Clinton read Fire and Fury on TV last night. I mean, U2 performed in front of the Statue of Liberty, and there were messages about details of public policy like the Dreamers, and it was all kind of undercut by giving every single award to an album that is just pure pop entertainment and fun. There's nothing wrong with Bruno Mars and with 24 Karat Magic, the album. It just kind of felt like there was a huge disconnect between the message of the Grammys saying, this is a really important thing. Music can transcend all these boundaries and do all these deep and meaningful things. And then to not reward that by giving album, record, song to things that did that felt like a big disconnect.
I saw an argument that Bruno Mars transcends generations in some ways, and that's why maybe he's winning awards. A lot of his stuff, and he specifically said, this stuff that I listened to back in the 80s was his direct inspiration, Morris Day and the Time and all the songwriters he mentioned in his speech. So it's, the kids like it, some of the grown-ups like it, that wins an award.
That is certainly an argument that can be made. Sometimes it feels like Bruno Mars is just taking the most successful things of the past and kind of cashing in on them, where a lot of the other nominations for Album and Record of the Year really pushed forward into the future and said things that are going to last and stand the test of time instead of just going back and rehashing the classics and things that worked.
Let's give a listen to another performance now. This one by Kendrick Lamar, Dave Chappelle, and U2's Bono appeared in this one. Here's a clip from his mashup last night.
Run your life, I live a better life. I'm rolling several days. Run your life, I live a better life. I'm rolling several days. Run your life, I live a... Run your life. This is my heritage, all I'm inheriting. Money and power to make a marriage.
So Kendrick Lamar won in Hip Hop Album of the Year. A lot of the rap type categories didn't win the overall awards. What do you think about that?
That was truly a high point in the night, and it was literally the first thing that happened. So I was ready for that to go up there. And by the time we got to hour two and Sting and Shaggy were performing their new single together, it really felt like that important moment had left, and we were entering into something that was truly falling apart. But Kendrick definitely has crushed critically, is the biggest artist in the world right now, and has continually been snubbed, and he's always almost there. The thing about the album of the year was that they were all great choices, and it felt like this was finally the time where the Grammys were going to take a side and say, you know, well, we're going to give it to the most critically lauded album of the year, and then they went with most popular.
Is this a pattern in the Grammys? Do the critically acclaimed ones, maybe the timeless ones, not get that award?
In 1995, Tony Bennett's MTV Unplugged album won Album of the Year. Certainly not one that has stood the test of time, or that anybody thinks of 1995 and thinks of that wonderful album. Yep. So it is a pattern that has happened year after year, is you have a nomination group that has some things that are strong and that last, and then what comes out of it is just kind of a wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, one of the some articles have pointed out people who never won Grammys. I think that included Jimi Hendrix, who I think you can make a case, you know, made some contributions to music in this country.
A little bit, yeah.
So what is your album of the year? Or you don't have to pick just one. Give us a couple of your albums of the year.
Well, I think that Kendrick certainly deserved it. Damn was an album that blew up, that crossed genres and borders. I even felt like in Record of the Year, Despacito was something that I was like kind of secretly pulling for, to be like, here is a song that has transcended countries. It transcends a language. It has become a number one hit in a country that doesn't speak his language, something that is incredibly difficult to do. I was kind of like pulling for that, just for that to have a moment, but it ultimately didn't win. Of course, popularity is a part of this, and I understand that. I would love to see it go to Big Thief's album Capacity, but I realize that they don't have the biggest audience. I understand what this is, and usually I am a bit of an apologist toward the Grammys, because I'm like, let's, you know, give it a chance. It is also about popularity. It's not just about critical appeal, but here they had a chance to give it to Kendrick Lamar's Damn, or Jay-Z 444, or Awaken My Love by Childish Gambino, and it ended up going to Bruno Mars, which was a disappointment.
Justin Barney is with us from Radio Milwaukee. We're looking at last night's Grammy Awards, the winners and the others. Something I wonder, Justin, as I not just see the show, but read the long list of different awards. I mean, there's the pop awards and hip-hop,
yeah,
and rock and country and metal and so on. I mean, do we have a common musical culture anymore?
Well, the thing about this award ceremony that I think that everybody can agree on is that it was way too long. There was too many performances, and with over 80 plus categories, there was less than 10 awards given over a period of 4 hours. I would have loved to see the diversity of music selected, the diversity of the winners, and the musical culture at large through having some of those tiny subcategories, like best album notes or best regional Mexican music. You know, they're like these little tiny categories that exist. I would have loved to see those presented instead of getting an onslaught of performances. They should have the performances. They are there, but maybe just like cut them in half and have it, you know, present more awards and less performances. There was twice as many performances as there were awards given. It felt a little off kilter, and it also just made it go very long and feel kind of drawn out.
What do you think of the kind of old timers showing up? You mentioned Sting, and we've talked about U2, a couple tributes to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Leonard Bernstein. Elton John, of course, performing
of course
last night. Something for all generations. Do you think that's why there are so many performances here?
I think that it is certainly important, and that should not be lost. There was a very great nod to Chuck Berry and to Fats Domino. It was a wonderful performance. And there were winners. You know, Leonard Cohen won Best Rock Performance. I loved seeing that. And it is very important to realize that music is something that moves with history, that it takes the present and it kind of like puts it into perspective. And then to look back at artists that were able to do that is a very important thing. It's important for the what's happening in music now and what's happening in music for the future. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. And it was great to see that portrayed last night. But I'm just saying, cut it down. You know, just cut the whole thing just like a little bit less, you know?
And Justin, when I look at something like the Grammys or whenever we talk about music on the show, I'm overwhelmed by how much music is out there. A lot of it, seriously, I know if I gave it a good shot, I'd like it. But there's so much hot. Where do we start as music fans and trying to expand our horizons a little?
You know, I was really shocked at, I mean, as I said, there's 80 plus categories, and there were even things that were up in like big categories that was like, I have no idea who these people are. And it is my job to know about music. So I would say if you're looking for something to start with the albums of the year. They were all fantastic. You know, Awaken My Love by Childish Gambino, Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar, Lorde. Kind of dig into all of those that were nominated for the big ones and just kind of peruse it. You know, I think that's the album and record of the year were good entry points into what is going on.
And who are you watching for in 2018?
It is Kendrick Lamar, always.
Again?
In 2018, again. I'm sure that Jack White will have a big year. Hopefully David Byrne, I mean, he's going to release an album this year. I'd love to see that nominated. And, you know, I'm always pulling for my, you know, my little bands like Super Organism, as they're going to release a debut album this year. And you hope for big things for maybe a new artist of the year or things to break out, because music is, you know, always happening and new people come up and down. So it's great to see everybody.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Justin Barney is music director at Radio Milwaukee. He joins us to talk about last night's Grammy Awards. We'll go out to the news with one of the winners, Feel It Still by Portugal the Man. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. First, American school books have taught about the separation of church and state as a key part of the country's history, but the U.S. still sees fights over everything from religious freedom laws to contraception and same-sex marriage. The frequent debates often bring up the same question, how separate is religion from public life? Andrew Copson is the chief executive of Humanists UK and author of the new book, Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to pin down a working definition anyway of secularism, because I think it means very different things to different people. Can you tell us how you think about secularism?
Yes, you're right. It does mean very different things to different people. And especially in US English, the word can often mean just a sort of generic non-religiousness. In UK English and internationally, it's used more specifically to refer to a political settlement. In my book, I use the definition by the French academic of secularism, Charles Babro, and he says that secularism is three things. Firstly, it's the separation of state institutions from religious institutions, so separation of church and state. Secondly, it's the state trying to achieve the maximum possible freedom of religion and belief for everybody within, of course, the limits of the rights of others, so, you know, free exercise. And thirdly, it's the state not discriminating against people because of their religion or non-religious belief. So, you know, no discrimination, equal treatment. Those three things together, at least what as Babro sees it, and I agree, and that's the definition I use in my book, those three things together make up secularism.
And I think a lot of people, religious people in the United States and around the world hear secularism and think of an anti-religious stance on the part, on the official part of the government. You see that as something different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right. A lot of religious people do see it as secularism as an anti-religious initiative. Of course, many religious people support secularism. And indeed, you know, some of the first secularists were religious. especially in the 17th century, Christian Baptists, nonconformists, and so on. But yeah, it's true that the word secularism and secular states around the world have acquired a bad reputation with some religious people for being anti-religious. Now, I think that's often to do with the fact that anti-religious states like the Soviet Union or Cuba or Albania under communism, or anti-religious states like China, also under communism, obviously, like to talk about themselves as secular. And they give secularism, I think, quite often a bad name because of this. Actually, those states aren't secular. They don't separate religion and state. They push it together. It's just that the state's religion in those circumstances is, you know, an atheist one. And they don't give free exercise. They don't give freedom. They don't treat people equally. So those states, although they claim to be secular, really quite often aren't. But they have, you're right, helped to tarnish the brand of secularism by that false advertising.
As I look at your book, I think one of the main points you're raising, one concern you're raising, is that the principles of secularism, as you just laid them out, are under threat in countries around the world. Can you talk about the threat you see?
Yeah, they're under threat almost everywhere. And in fact, in the last 10 to 20 years, if there is such a thing as a global trend, it's away from secularism in states. You know, it's away from separation of church and state. It's away from free exercise. And that's true in countries like India, Turkey, Russia, some to some extent countries like the United States. It's true in countries that once were secular states. But it's also true in countries that aren't secular states, like many Arab states, and where even the small number of secularists that do exist are persecuted, targeted, and so on. And the forces that are laying siege to secularism are various. I mean, you have religious extremism, of course. There's always been an enemy of secularism. And you see that in Islamic states like Iran. You see that in states like India, where Hindu nationalism is a very strong form of religious extremism. There's also a new sort of ethnic nationalism that is trying to diminish secularism. You see that in the use of the Orthodox Church by, for example, Putin's regime in Russia. You see it, I think, in some of the Christian elements of America First. You see it in India as well. And then there's also, as well as religious extremism and this sort of ethnic nationalism, there's just the sort of good old-fashioned conservatism, really, which has also been a perennial enemy of secularism, that just wants to see societies as primarily religious, you know, that says America is a Christian country, or, you know, France is a Catholic one, or Turkey is an Islamic one. And instead of accepting that these countries should be run by states that treat people equally, want instead to give it a religious character out of sort of conservative leanings. So those three primary forces are the forces against secularism today. There are also, unfortunately, many more.
Talking to Andrew Copson, his new book is Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. As we're hearing, he's worried that the ideas of secularism and the protection of people of different religions within a country to practice their religion may be under threat. An argument goes, and you see this in, as you were just saying, different countries with different religions around the world. If you are in a representative democracy of some sort and the vast bulk of the public shares a particular set of religious beliefs, shouldn't that government and its laws reflect the religious beliefs of the and moral beliefs of the majority of that country?
Yeah, people do make that argument. That's not an argument that is consistent with liberal democracy. It might be consistent with, you know, an idea of mob rule or majority rule, where you say, well, most people think X, and therefore people who think Y can just suck it up and get over it. That's not the sort of political order that I would want to live under. It's not the sort of political order that is envisaged in things like international human rights treaties or in the constitutions of states that had their origin in Enlightenment thought, like, for example, France or the United States of America. But yeah, you're right. Some people do make that argument for, you know, essentially majority mob rule and say, listen, you know, we think this, so everyone should have it the way that we want it. That's not a civilized attitude, in my view.
And some people have pointed toward anti-secularism these days as maybe a backlash against an overly aggressive form of secularism in some countries. I'm thinking here of Turkey, where there were bans on certain types of religious clothing for women who would want to go into public service, and that made them choose between their personal religious beliefs and being able to do a job in government or even healthcare.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Turkey is a very particular example, of course, because in Turkey, secularism wasn't introduced like it was in France or America by, you know, popular support in popular revolutions. Secularism in Turkey was introduced from the top down by Atatürk when he was president for life of the first Turkish Republic. And for as long as there have been democratic elections in Turkey, secularism has slowly been eroded, because the truth is that with most Turkish voters anyway, it wasn't really their preference for a governing system. So you're right. Part of the resurgence of religious attitudes, and particularly Islamizing attitudes in Turkey, has been as a backlash against secularism. But Turkish secularism is very peculiar. I mean, it's a sort of secularism that on the one hand tried to keep, and I think we can almost talk about it in the past tense now, tried to keep state institutions, public institutions like schools and universities and hospitals, secular, and remove religion influence from them. But at the same time, actually, it tried to regulate and control religious organizations. So while on the one hand it tried to secularize state organizations, it didn't give fair freedom to religious organizations. And the Ministry of Religious Affairs in Turkey, which is still a department of the government, trains all the imams, licenses all the mosques, writes the sermons to be delivered. I mean, it's a bizarre situation. So you're right, there is some sense in seeing the religious resurgence as a backlash against secularism in some countries, but I think Turkey is a very particular example.
We're talking to Andrew Copson. He's chief executive of Humanists UK. His new book is called Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Do you feel like the United States is living up to its secular past, its secular ideals? Do you see the U.S. as primarily a Christian nation, and you think laws and the political system should reflect that? Are you concerned about the survival of secular principles here in the U.S. and around the world? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Andrew Copson. He's chief executive of Humanists UK and author of the book Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. He says secular ideals, things like separation of church and state, protection of religious freedoms, even among religious minority groups, is under threat around the globe. You can share your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Do you think secularism is a good ideal for a government to operate under? How should it take shape in the United States? Do you see, as our guest does, threats to it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. My comment has to do with a particular way that supporters of religious education in the country managed to get the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution in such a way that allows parents to determine where their children should go to school under this idea of school choice. But the effect of it is for various groups that are promoting the idea to be able to use public funding, taxpayer funding, to fund religious education in the country. And in Wisconsin, that's certainly growing very, very quickly.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. And Andrew, this is one of those flashpoints in secularism. How does religious education and public funding thereof fit in?
Yes, that's right. And I mean, many secular states with secular constitutions have struggled with this issue in practice. And as your caller rightly said, the United States Constitution has been subject to several different interpretations over the decades and centuries by the Supreme Court as to precisely what establishment and precisely what free exercise means. But it's certainly the case that secular states struggle with the question of whether or not religious citizens should have the right to call on public money to have their children educated in line with the parental religion. And some secular states do permit that. They say, okay, you know, free exercise means that we ought to really allow this. And if citizens really want it, as long as money is provided on an equal and impartial basis between religions, then it should be allowed. Other secular states say, well, look, children are people too, and children have a right to be educated in a way that will allow them to have their own free exercise and their own choices in life without having the parental preference reinforced in the school. And after all, everyone, you know, in some sense, has minority views as well as views of a group or views of a majority. And it's impossible to have so many schools as would cater for every single eccentricity of parental opinion. But this is not an easy question. This is a question that secular states struggle with. And different secular states, as I say, address differently. I think that my personal view is that it is sensible for public schools to teach about religions and about non-religious approaches to life like humanism, and to try and make the children of all families feel welcome within the single school environment. But that it's in principle wrong for state schools, public schools, as you would call them, to seek to inculcate religion in children, that it's an abuse of children's rights, and in the long term it's impractical in a country with religious diversity, because you just will never provide for everybody.
Ben, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Robert in Ripon. Robert, hi.
Hi. I just think that we should focus on the point that American secularism is designed to protect individuals' religious freedom. It is there to prevent having the government or some supposed agent of the government forcing a specific religious view on individuals. It is not an attempt to go against religion. It's against depriving us of our own freedom to pursue our own religious beliefs.
Robert, thanks a lot for that call. What do you think, Andrew? Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah, I think it certainly is. I mean, that's certainly the way that American secularism has ended up being interpreted. I'm not sure if it was the way in which American secularism was originally intended. I think it's there are arguments about that. I think there are good reasons to think that a large number of framers of the amendments to the Constitution were to some extent believers in the idea that religion itself was old-fashioned, was unnecessary for a modern state, and actually got in the way of modernity. But your caller is right that the American secularism at its heart is about protecting the liberties of believers in religious or non-religious views to be able to go about their business in freedom. And to that extent, American secularism is slightly different in quality, in flavor, as it were, from other types of secularism in the world. I mean, there's an argument that sees French secularism, for example, as very different from American secularism, because whereas American secularism is about protecting individuals' religious freedoms from the state, French secularism is much more about protecting individuals from religion. And there are historical reasons for that, because of the anti-clerical, anti-Catholic nature of the French Revolution, because the Catholic Church was so oppressive and controlling in France under the monarchy, whereas America didn't have any one central religious institution that was so dominating in people's lives. And every secularism in the world has its own flavor. In India, secularism is primarily a way of dealing with diversity, you know, protecting everyone from everybody else, you know, and managing to keep everyone in religious freedom, because in India, the continent of India, there's a long history of religious conflict and strife and civil war. So every secularism has its own flavor. And your caller is right. American secularism, the strongest flavor of it is about protecting individuals' liberties and protecting those liberties from the state.
Thanks for that call, Robert. We're talking about secularism with our guest, Andrew Copson. His new book is called Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. And Andrew, as we come to the end of our conversation, I want to spend a little time on the beginning of secularism. Speaking of a region in the midst of wars and civil wars, I want to think back to, you know, after the Reformation in Europe, you had Catholics and Protestants and different kinds of Protestants all at war with each other. The principle that if I rule the region, I get to pick the religion. So when you change a king, you might have to change your religion along with him. How do we get from there to this idea of secularism?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, there were many intellectual contributions to the development of secularism. One of them was sort of pre-Christian, harking back to the pre-Christian world, where, as you know, in the city-states of ancient Greece, although there were public temples, the mandates of religion were kept quite separate from politics. And Aristotle, the first author on politics in the European tradition, says that the aims of the state are the same as the aims of human life, you know, to seek flourishing and happiness for the people, you know, very, very secular, this worldly aims. So there's an ancient pre-Christian tradition that people started to draw on in later modern Europe. There's also resources within Christianity itself for secularism, although the norm for most of Christianity's reign in Europe was to, put down opposition, to destroy heresy, to eliminate alternative ways of thinking. Christianity also had at its heart this distinction of rendering to Caesar what is Caesar and rendering to God what is God. So there were resources within Christianity for an idea of separation of church and state in principle, and it's ideas like this that inspired the Baptists in both Europe and then in the colonies in North America. And then there, of course, is the European and Western Enlightenment and the intellectual currents that flowed through Western Europe and through what was to become the United States, that said for the first time, really, that government got its authority not from God through the monarch, but from the consent of the people, from the consent of the governed. And that political idea that was so revolutionary in Enlightenment thought and led to actual revolutions in France and America, when you applied that idea to religion, a natural consequence of that was that individuals should be free, not just as citizens, but as believers, to follow their own paths and their own consciences. And there's the blending of these traditions, Christian, Enlightenment, humanist, ancient pre-Christian traditions, that gave rise to secularism in the West. That's half the story. Secularism in the rest of the world, including in India, has a different intellectual heritage. But in the West, that's how it came to be.
Getting back to your concerns about global trends away from secularism around the world, do you hope, do you see a chance that that is going to turn around anytime soon?
I think the progress in this area, if we make it, will always be uneven. I think that there is a sort of cycle of religious extremism and then secularism that comes in a sort of boom and bust, a bit like economic booms and busts and crashes and rises. And I think that over time, the trajectory is in a secular direction. The benefits of secularism in terms of individual freedom, in terms of social justice, in terms of peace and democracy and equal citizenship, the benefits of secularism once realized are defended. There will always be people to defend them. And I think that over time, progress is in the right direction, yes.
And briefly, Andrew, while these general principles are out there, there are always these little gray areas that become controversies, funding for schools, public prayer at a meeting. Do you think these flashpoints overshadow the wider, what you see as benefits of secularism just in our last few moments?
Yeah, I do think they overshadow them. And I think that people today can be very driven by their own identity. One of the differences in matters of religion and non-religious worldviews today is that whereas 200 years ago they were much more about beliefs and your own conscience and what you thought was true in your own mind, today they're very much about identity. And I think that this has lots of explanations. Of course, there are people in historically Christian countries that look at immigration from people of very different religions.
And we'll have to leave it there. Sorry to ask a big question. That's Andrew Copps, and his new book is Secularism, Politics, Religion, and Freedom. On Friday, we learned about Bitcoin and other virtual currencies, how they work, and how they might be vulnerable to manipulation. Turns out now there's another way to learn about Bitcoin from a Japanese pop band. The band is called Virtual Currency Girls. They debuted this month. It's eight young women singers in Japan who wear masks. They sing songs about virtual currency, the opportunities, and the risks. And they only accept payment in virtual currency, Bitcoin, and all the rest. Now, there was news this week, and a major hack froze one of their accounts. There's a big hack in the virtual currency world, and this band, their money was frozen in it. They were offered to be paid in Japanese yen instead by their management. They refused. They're holding out for their Bitcoin. So it turns out that you can learn about Bitcoin by listening to us here on Central Time, or take a shortcut, learn to speak Japanese, and find the latest track from the Virtual Currency Girls. We'll go out with their first single. We'll see if there's more after this. It translates as The Moon and Virtual Currencies and Me. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm not afraid to die.